South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. For the fall term of court, our August term. First case scheduled for this morning is State of South Dakota Life and Health Guarantee Association versus South Dakota Bankers Benefit Plan Trust. The appellant is present, represented in, by Tara Larson, who will be arguing this morning. And Appalee Association is present, represented by Michael Schneider, who will be arguing on behalf of the Appalee. Each side will have 20 minutes initially for your argument. Then Ms. Larson, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. The warning light will come on when you have 2 minutes, the yellow warning light. With that, Ms. Larson, you may proceed with your argument.
For the court today is whether the association can assess the trust after it was statutorily relieved of its membership status on July 1st, 2019. I think to start this analysis, it's important that we look at what the association is. The association is a legal nonprofit entity, and it is basic entity law that the liabilities of the association are not necessarily the liabilities of the members. We need to look at the statutes and the bylaws, in this case the plan of operation would be the bylaws, to determine the members' liability as it relates to the association. So in starting out, I'd like to look at the statutes first, and we would look to the purpose statute. In SDCL 5829C45, under the purpose, it states that members of the association are subject to assessment. That's its general discussion of members in the purpose. Which brings us to, what are assessments? Well, this is a Class B assessment. So therefore, we would look at 5829C52C, which discusses Class B assessments and states they are authorized and called to provide funds to carry out the purpose of the association. The term authorized assessment is defined in 5829C48(3) as authorized upon resolution. Called assessment is considered called when notice is sent to be paid in part in a time frame set forth by that notice, which brings us to the 2017 resolution in this matter. The association is arguing that the trust's liability incurred for the entire estimated $43 million of the Penn Treaty issue in 2017. However, nowhere in that resolution does it authorize payment for the full estimated $43 million. It authorizes $8.8 million. While yes, the resolution does talk about the potential of future assessments, nowhere in the resolution or the minutes does it bind the members to that $43 million. The assessment was called in 2017, shortly thereafter, and repeated in years. The trust paid all assessments authorized and called when it was a member. However, thereafter, in 2020, after it was no longer a member and the assessment was authorized by resolution, and then called thereafter, after it was no longer a member, we protested and the present appeal began. Now, nothing in the statute states that a member becomes liable for payment for insolvencies when the association does. For instance, let's take a look at the definition of member insurer. The definition of member insurer provides that insurers whose licenses have been suspended or revoked, etc., will remain members for the purposes of the chapter. However, the association is not an insurer. Post-July 1st, 2019, we were relieved of our statutory obligation of doing so, and the definition that is left in 29C 4812 specifically exempts us as we operate on an assessment basis. Now, additionally, 581890 specifically says both pre- and post-enactment of Senate Bill 37 that METS, which is the trust, shall not be construed as insurers. So the trust, post-repeal of the requirement that we be a member, is not considered an insurer by definition, which brings us to the plan of operation in this situation. In Record R, Article 6, Section B, the plan of operation states, an insurer which ceases to be admitted shall automatically cease to be a member, effective on the day following the termination of its license to transact kinds of insurance covered by the Act. Well, we never had our license revoked. We never had our license withdrawn. We are not an insurer. However, the very next sentence says, however, such insurer shall remain liable on any assessments based on insolvencies occurring prior to the termination of its license. That language is paramount. Penn Treaty liquidation did not deal with assessments based on impairments. It dealt with assessment an insolvent insurer. Now, it's important to look at the definition of an impaired insurer versus an insolvent insurer. An impaired insurer is in an order of rehabilitation and specifically states, quote, is not an insolvent insurer. Additionally, insolvent insurers, defined in 5829C4811, is an insurer in an order of liquidation. Now, the association argues that just because the language says impairments doesn't mean anything because Penn Treaty was impaired before it was insolvent, so really, it's a distinction without a difference. Such an interpretation is downright counter to the record in this matter. The association itself only became liable for Penn Treaty when it was placed in an order of liquidation on March 1, 2017. Also on March 1, 2017, the association signed its promissory note that made it liable for the order of liquidation. At no point was it liable when it was put under impairment. Well, yes, the order did reference that at some point Penn Treaty was in rehabilitation. The order specifically vacated that order of rehabilitation. As such, regardless of whether Penn Treaty was an impairment at some point, and regardless of whether an impairment is a precursor to an insolvency, it doesn't change the fact that all assessments on the trust, both prior to it being a member and after it being a member, were assessments based on insolvency.
So what do we do with the plan of operation? Even if we put aside for a moment the question of a member insurer and having a license to operate as an insurer, and we get to this impairment clause as you've just outlined, and there's a distinction, as you say, between impairment and insolvency. What do we do with the plan of operation? Does it matter? It occurs to me that the plan wouldn't even really accomplish anything because, in that regard or on that section, because they wouldn't assess for impairments anyway. So is it just a drafting failure? Or what do we do with it? Does it have any effect at all?
Justice Salter, that was actually fixed by the association in 2020. They actually amended their language to allow them to assess based on insolvencies. Well, I will say that we were no longer a member in 2020, so it doesn't apply to us.
But they wouldn't assess for it. Well, and I'll ask both sides, but would they assess for an impairment anyway? I mean, the whole idea, I thought, was that you had this sort of terminal level of intervention known as liquidation, and now it's time for the assessment because you're going to have to assume some responsibilities, which might not have existed during this impairment or sort of lesser level of supervision. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Certainly, Justice. I think it's important to note, I understand that that's their argument, that in practice they have assess based on insolvencies only, but here's the thing. If that was the case, they should have written their language that way. We look at the plain reading of this language, and it specifically says it does not. It's also important to note that the association, through their attorneys that are arguing here, wrote the plan of operation, saying they really don't, you know, mean to limit themselves to just assessments based on impairments is essentially saying, do as I say, not as what the law I wrote says.
Councilman, doesn't my read of the statutes is that they allow for assessments in an impairment situation? It's not mandated, but it appears there's a provision that says they may assess on an impairment.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's why when they changed their plan of operation, they allowed for assessments based on both impairments and insolvencies. So the statutes do contemplate assessments based on impairments as well, even though in practice they do not do that. Which brings me to my next next point. Ultimately, in this situation, nothing in the statutes or the plan of operation gives the association the power for assessments that are authorized and called after it ceased to be a member on July 1st, 2019. However, I think it's additionally important because it brings us into our next point of discussion of ERISA here, that the statutes themselves, 5829C46, specifically states that the association isn't covered. And that has been the same way since we were members of the association and after. Furthermore, Mr. Gullickson admitted so much in Record M, saying that it doesn't matter that we could never receive a benefit from the association. There's still no violation to ERISA, which gets us into the ERISA provisions.
It seems like opposing counsel is arguing, if I understood correctly, that the fact that the 5818 statute says that you are a member under, and then cross references the 5829A4812 statute, that then that means they are, notwithstanding. But I understand. I mean, it's a very interesting legislative scheme to try to follow here. That definitional statute then refers back to 46, which says they aren't covered. So how do we interpret all of that and apply the definitional statute in your view?
Certainly, Justice. As the court is aware, we must read our statutes in pari materia, right? And so the way that one would interpret that is prior to 2019, the repeal of that, essentially it says in 581888 says they shall be a member of the association pursuant to the cross-reference of 5829C48. So essentially how the court would have read that prior to 2019 is essentially adding a line at the bottom of, you know, section 48 of 29C saying, and Mets shall be members, right? Following the repeal of 581888, that provision simply struck. Now, if the legislature had wanted to anticipate, like it did for former members of the association that had their license revoked, etc., they would have added a provision in 5829C48, I believe it was, is it 11? Don't, yes, 11.
12, say, I think it's 12.
Sorry. To say, you know, this includes a former member of under, you know, the repealed 581888, but they did not do so. Now, going into the ERISA issue, I think it's very important to point out that this court doesn't need to decide the ERISA issue. If the court decides that the association had no power to assess the trust after it ceased to be a member, we stop there. Our analysis ends there. This is only if the court decides that somehow the association can assess the trust that we have to go into the ERISA argument. And I would note, ERISA is a very complex issue. People dedicate their entire careers to ERISA, which, you know, makes sense in this, that there's some confusion as to how this is maybe a relates to issue. This is not a relates to issue. Our issue specifically in this is whether the law 581888 violates the exclusive benefit rule of ERISA. It clearly relates to, because it mentions ERISA in the statute. It's straightforward as that. Now, the exclusive benefit rule specifically says assets of a plan shall be held for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to its participants in the plan and their beneficiaries and defraying reasonable expenses of administration of the plan. Now, at the start, forwarding over $77,000 a year of planned assets to an association that the trust could absolutely never receive a benefit from, coming from the executive director specifically, is not using the plan assets for providing a benefit to the participants. Now, there are exceptions to this rule, and the association's trying to fit into those. The association calls this a law of general applicability, and they use the Boyle case as an example, which is an Eighth Circuit case, as an example of, oh, how this is a rule of general applicability. But the Boyle case is actually a very good example of a rule that is a rule of general applicability and how this case is distinguished from that. In that case, they dealt with a general health care tax that was applicable to all health care institutions of 2%. That tax went to the general fund of Minnesota to benefit all Minnesotan citizens. Now, that health care tax was allowed to pass through to various plans, including some ERISA plans, but not all ERISA plans. The ERISA people, you know, filed suit saying that there was a violation, and the court ultimately found that, well, this is a law of general applicability that could benefit the citizens as a whole. What we have here is materially opposite of that. We have a law, 58-1888, that applies only to ERISA plans, and luckily just one. The association argues that, you know, simply because it's just one, we don't have a law of discrete applicability. It could be multiple. Well, if it were multiple, the analysis doesn't change because it's a multiple ERISA plans, be it one or 200, that could never receive a benefit whatsoever from their various assessments.
Counsel, is your ERISA argument dependent upon the court finding that there was no coverage for the trust members under the statutory scheme? Or would there be anything left of the argument if we were to find that pre-58-1888 amendment, they were covered?
Your Honor, I think that the analysis would depend on coverage, but the language itself in 58-29C46 specifically excludes the trust. And that has been unchanged from the get-go. So I don't necessarily think that's a question. I think that's pretty clear in the law. Now, going back to the exclusive benefit rule here, there are anticipations for what are considered reasonable administration fees that go to, basically administration of the plan itself. So what we're looking at in that situation is, for instance, filing fees and registration fees, for instance, with the Division of Insurance. That would be considered a reasonable administration fee in this situation. Again, the $77,000 per year, and let's face it, the Penn Treaty Plan dealt with long-term care insurance. Assessments are going to be made until the very last holder of that plan passes away, and that could be an innumerable amount of years for that. That is not a reasonable expense. The association calls this then essentially a cost of doing business. Well, if it's a cost of doing business in that situation, then is this really a law regulating insurance? The question of that, you have to look at the Kentucky Health Plan case where there's two prongs where the law has to be directed at entities engaging in insurance. Well, 58-1890 specifically says it's not an insurer. And two, it must substantially relate to the risk pooling between the insured and the insurers. Well, again, if this is simply a cost of doing business, essentially a tax, then this is clearly not dealing with the risk pooling in this situation. Furthermore, if this were considered a tax, it is most certainly preempted. Case law is very, very clear on that, that, you know, a tax that relates to an ERISA plan is preempted. Ultimately, the assessments on the trust lead to its assets going to money other than the exclusive purpose of benefiting plan participants and cannot be said to be reasonably or to be considered reasonable administrative expenses. Section
Counsel, can you, before you're done, address the prejudgment interest question?
Justice, you read my mind. That was my very next sentence. So with regard to the prejudgment interest, damages are defined as the wrongful detention of money in this situation. The issue with judge's order in that situation is it allowed for prejudgment interest back to, I believe it was April of 2021, when the association paid back the trust pursuant to the Office of Hearing Examiner's rule in order that they were to pay it back.
And the money is still there with the trust?
No, not anymore. We have refunded it because we did not want to continue to pay prejudgment interest pursuant to the order. But that being stated, I think it's rather interesting that the association would say, well, we paid interest too. As a reference, the association paid pursuant to 5829C and interest actually earned. They paid us $11.40 total. We, conversely, pursuant to this order, or pursuant to the order of prejudgment interest, had to pay $42.71 per day, amounting to over $13,000. Now, if anything, prejudgment interest is inappropriate when we're relying on an order. If anything, the court should have awarded prejudgment interest following the entry of its order. We could see that in that situation because we were no longer relying on an order. Ultimately, we would ask the court to reverse the circuit court's matter in all matters. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Snyder, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Snyder. I'm here on behalf of the South Dakota Life and Health Guarantee Association. The Guarantee Association provides a safety net for South Dakota residents who are holders of policies issued by troubled insurance companies. To do that, South Dakota law requires the association's members to effectively chip in an assigned share of money. The trust here was a member by law. A decision was made, however, to benefit the association's members by spreading out this monetary burden over the course of several years instead of calling it all due at one time. Now the trust, after paying several assessments, is trying to avoid its responsibility while forcing all of the association's other members to pick up its portion of the bill, which could also jeopardize the integrity of the safety net and the association's ability to do its job.
Could it have called the entire amount due at the outset of the liquidation order? Did it know the number?
We could have called everything due, Your Honor, as soon as the amount was determined.
And by call, I don't mean call, because that's a term of art. Could they have authorized the assessment?
We could have.
The definition seems to suggest it requires a specific amount.
Yes, Your Honor. If in reference to Exhibit D, that is the April 5, 2017 minutes from the Board of the Directors, which is where we had determined the actuarial number for the obligation of all these policies over their lifetime to be approximately $40 million and some 100 after that. From that number, that would have gone to the association's member according to their pro rata share of premiums that they received in the state during the 3 years prior to the Penn Treaty liquidation.
But in any event, thank you for that, but in any event, the association didn't do that, as you say. They did it perhaps for the convenience of their members or whatever. What statutory basis exists, having made that decision, that would allow you to proceed as you suggest now? In other words, maybe that was just a fateful decision, and that was just the way it goes.
So the way that the obligations of the members are divvied up, we look at March 1 of 2017, so that's the date of the Penn Treaty liquidation. At that time, the association by law is obligated to provide statutory benefits to the South Dakota holders of Penn Treaty policies. Also, at the same time, the association is obligated to assess its members for the funds needed to fulfill that obligation. So that obligation exists as of March 1 of 2017. And then going forward, each member's share of that obligation is determined according to SDCL 29C 52 sub C sub 2, that states each member's share of that is determined based upon their pro rata share of premiums received during the 3 years preceding the liquidation. So what that does is it's like there's a snapshot that's taken on March 1 of 2017, and we look back 3 years. And every member of the association who received premiums during that three-year look-back period, all of those premiums are pooled together into a pie, and each member gets a percentage of that pie based upon essentially their market share that they had at that time.
You didn't have the 2016 numbers at that point, though, did you? So you were going to use 13 instead?
Correct, Your Honor. The statute allows us to use either the three preceding years or the years that we had available. When the liquidation happened, we didn't have the numbers for 2016 yet. I think those usually come out in October. And so what we did is we used 13, 14, and 15, and then on the next year we did a true-up to bring it all current. But that part there about the premiums being assessed based on that three-year look back is really the critical part, because if the court agrees with the trust, then the question is, where does the association pick up the difference? Because that statute doesn't allow us to look back and take out the premiums that were received by the trust and pretend it didn't exist, or to redo that number again. We have to use that preceding 3 years while the trust was a member. And there's also nothing that allows the association to effectively redistribute the trust share onto the association's other members. If the association goes to the members now and says, look, you need to make up the difference for this, they could conceivably say, you know, I've already paid my fair share based on that statutory apportionment. And I think the absence of a statute saying when a member withdraws, you effectively go back in time and pretend that they didn't exist is a strong indication of the legislature's intent that members who were members when these obligations arose cannot get out from under that obligation that existed, in this case, as of March 1 of 2017. And that would be keeping with the statute that says the act must be construed to effectuate its purpose, which is SDCL 5829C-47. And the purpose of the act is to ensure that the association can provide statutory benefits to South Dakota policyholders by assessing the members of the association to do that.
But that purpose could be fulfilled if you lose one of your members. That purpose could still be fulfilled by just reassessing your other members, couldn't it?
If the association's other members, Your Honor, were to say, well, look, I paid my fair share already based on this statutory apportionment rule, that creates a question that isn't readily answered by our statutes as to what happens then. Where do we make up the difference? And so I think I read these to say that snapshot is really the key part. Anything that happens after that really doesn't matter, because all of the premiums are pooled at that time and everybody's share is also determined. The dollar amount that ultimately is determined comes later. The obligation, though, exists then. And so when the dollar amount is determined, it's then filtered down according to that distribution, but it's already determined as of March 1 of 2017.
Does your argument here depend upon us applying the plan of operation in conjunction with the statutes?
It does not, Your Honor. I would say the plan of operation is really the secondary argument. We believe these statutes on their face would control, and the plan of operation is really sort of a buttress to that. I believe it would support what these statutes are already saying, that a member can't get out from under this pre-existing obligation simply by withdrawing.
So other than the general purpose statute and SDCL 58-29C45, what other statutes do you rely on to support that the bankers group was responsible for the assessment after they were no longer a member?
SDCL 58-29C-51 is the statute that requires the association to incur the obligations at the time of the liquidation order, and then SDCL 58-29C-52A is what requires the association to assess its members, and then SDCL 58-29C-52, sub C, sub 2, is the one that provides for that apportionment rule in the three-year look back, Your Honor. Now, there was very little discussion about Senate Bill 37 and what it did here, and the argument here has really morphed as time went on. When this dispute started, the trust only pointed to Senate Bill 37. It said, that's it. That's the only reason why we are protesting these assessments. You can look in Record J, which is AP 79. That's the letter from the trust following its receipt of the 2020 assessment. It only identified Senate Bill 37. As this lawsuit has gone on, Senate Bill 37 has been given less and less focus, less and less attention. And I think that's because the trust realizes that to do what it's asking the court to do is going to require a retroactive application of law, which we cannot do. If we go back to that pool again under 58-29C-52C, what the trust is asking this court to do is one of two things that the Act doesn't allow. Either one, go back in time, pretend the trust didn't exist, and extract its premiums from that three-year look-back period, and recalculate that snapshot, as I've called it, or two, to just reassign the association's other members a greater share of that pool than what is allowed by law. Senate Bill 37 doesn't do either of those things. It only removes the trust mandatory membership. But in effect, that's what the trust is asking the court to do here. And our legislature has been very clear that laws can't be given retroactive effect, and also that the repeal of any law can't alter pre-existing obligations unless it expressly says so. But Senate Bill 37 here doesn't do that.
If we did not accept your interpretation of the statute, that the statutory scheme that, as you've laid out in your view, made the trust and all the members liable at the time of the liquidation in the statutes that then kicked into play, can you explain, is it your position then that the plan of operation then would be what we would look to as another reason why they are nevertheless liable?
I think the plan of operation, Your Honor, does go on to confirm that. The associations are required to submit that to the director, which becomes effective on the director's approval, and all members are bound by the plan of operation. And here, by law, again, the trust was a member pursuant to 58-18-88 sub 6. The plan of operation language that we're really focusing on, in our view, in our interpretation, confirms that former members shall remain liable for any assessments that are based on impairments that occurred prior to the termination of its license. I understand the trust is saying, well, we didn't have our license terminated. In the ordinary course, an insurer, as a condition of its license, is required to be a member of the association, so they go hand in hand. In this instance, the legislature did something which was just removing a member's obligation to remain a member. You normally couldn't do that without also forfeiting your license. And so the intent of the plan of operation is to say former members who withdraw, you can't just get out from under these assessments that are going to come due to obligations that arose while you were a member.
So if I'm understanding your argument, you're saying the plan of operation just bolsters the statutes which already create the obligation. If we interpret the statutes and read those not to create that obligation prior to the time that the bankers group withdrew from the association, Is the plan of operation itself sufficient to support your claim for liability, and if so, how?
I believe so, Your Honor. Because the plan of operation creates another, by law, every member has to follow it, and so I think the plan of operations language lays out an additional avenue here. But I think it's written to sort of track what the statutes are saying by pointing to the absence of any statute that says if a member withdraws, this is what the association is supposed to do, go back and pretend they didn't exist. This is saying that those members still remain obligated to fill obligations that arose while they were a member of the association.
How do you explain the issue between impairment and solvency, and why, given that choice of language, our attempt to interpret it, how do we ignore the statutory distinctions between the two and accept the argument that there's a distinction with no difference here?
So an impaired insurer is one that isn't insolvent. It's been placed under an order of rehabilitation. An insolvent insurer is one that's liquidated. While an impaired insurer is not insolvent, an insolvent insurer is fully impaired. It's so impaired that it's no longer able to do business anymore. To use sort of a crude analogy, it's sort of the difference between the insurance company being placed on life support and the insurance company being deceased.
Well, but I'm sorry, I'm going more to the statutory distinction between what the association has to do when there is an insolvency, whereas an impairment, it's a may.
Correct.
So that seems to be the more significant distinction, is particularly when that's what you're relying upon, those mandatory things that kick into place on an insolvency that aren't there with an impairment.
The distinction really makes a difference to split apart the association's obligations into the discretionary versus mandatory category. If there's an impairment that occurs, the association can step in and basically do what it did here. We don't typically do that because the better course is usually to see what happens and to hopefully save our members money. They don't have to pay for things that ultimately end up not being necessary. The insolvency, though, is what requires the association to mandatorily get involved and provide the protections. And so that's really why the distinction in the statute is there, to say if this happens, you can get involved. If this happens, you must get involved. But the insolvent insurer still is a effectively fully impaired insurer.
But the assessment here is based on the insolvency, not the impairment, isn't it?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that the insolvency, again, being analogous to a fully impaired insurer, it doesn't make a difference, because the impairment happened, yes, while the trust was a member. The insolvency happened while the trust was a member, so it became fully impaired and insolvent. And so it is all related to the impairment. It's just a fully impaired.
Except the association never did an assessment or determined there was any liability based on the impairment itself, did it?
While it remained under rehabilitation, no, Your Honor, it didn't. No. But again, here the impairment simply just ripened into the insolvency, which is often what happens at the end of the rehabilitation period. And so in our view, it really doesn't make a distinction that it became fully impaired, and that's when the assessments were made. With the few minutes that I have, I would like to just briefly touch on the ERISA issue. And just a few quick points. There's a presumption against preemption. That's the United States Supreme Court has been very clear on that. Acceptance of the trust's literalism-based position would mean that ERISA also prohibits the trust from paying things like taxes, rent, overhead, anything not 100% directly to the benefit of its members. On that point, I'm not aware of any case law that's ever been cited that says for the purpose of ERISA, we have to look at what the benefit to the plan is. That's just been an argument that's raised that we've tried to address, but I'm not aware of that being an actual legal requirement to look at, well, what's the level of benefit being given to the plan. However, here, the trust members did benefit by its membership in the association. One, it was allowed to do business and exist in the state. It had no other right to do that. Certainly its members benefited by the trust's existence. And two, the association has taken the position that it would have been entitled to the safety net of the association. And we appended that argument that we had raised to the circuit court, where we went back through the legislative history and we pointed out how the statutes that seem to say entities like the trust can't be entitled to benefits were enacted earlier, and the statute that said the trust needed to be a member of the association came later. So using the doctrine of the latest in time statute controls, the association would have been entitled to all the benefits of membership. The fact that it didn't need them does not mean that it didn't benefit from that. That argument, too, I would just note the trust never disputed that, and today here still has not disputed that our analysis of that was wrong.
Maybe I'm wrong, but if I understand the way the trust is constructed, it really would be unlikely that they would need that, because they have a means and a method of assessing their own member employers in the case of an insolvency.
I believe, Your Honor, that actually was a change by Senate Bill 37. I don't believe that that was in place at the time. But in any event, to the extent that it wasn't able to do that, let's say, and cover its obligations, then the association's position was that it would have been entitled to the same protections as everybody else.
So, counsel,
go ahead.
Finish. Go
ahead. No, you're on the same topic. I'm going to change.
Well, so the 46 statute, though, that says they aren't covered, that was amended after the 58-1888 was enacted to revise a provision of the ERISA cross-reference there. So that seems to me to be contrary to your suggestion that it was just repealed by implication.
I'm sorry. I don't believe that that provision was addressed. I think it added certain other portions. But I think just the way the statutes were arrayed at the time, that it would have been entitled to protection. If it was changed after the trust withdrew, then that would probably be putting it back in the position that it was earlier. Seeing that I'm out of my time, I would just note that we believe the circuit court's assessment of prejudgment interest is correct under the statute cited in our brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. You may proceed with your 10-minute rebuttal, Ms. Larson.
Ms. Larson, can I ask you a question as you're getting your things together there? The argument from Mr. Snyder seems to be that the three-year look back, which is, I think it's the reference to 5829C, 52C, probably 2, which is the Class B, assessment section. Is it a method of funding it? Is it, you know, what is that, and how do you respond to that question in light of your other statutory arguments?
Justice, you must have been a mind reader, because the very first thing that I was going to say was that. Now, Mr. Snyder is referring to 5829C, 52 sub C. If you look at 5829C 52 sub D, there's actually provisions that contemplate exactly what we're seeking to do. Those provisions deal with abatement, an abatement that does not have to be paid back. It specifically says if the association determines that an assessment would endanger the ability to fulfill that member's obligations, they may abate. Or defer, but abate, specifically in this situation, and there is no requirement for them to pay back that assessment versus the deferral option. In that case, what happens per statute is that that member's obligation is spread out between the rest of the insurers. So there is statutory provisions allowing for the association to spread out the liability to the rest of its members' insurers.
But in either event, thank you for that, but in either event, I'm trying to figure out if whether what we're talking about in either C or D, for that matter, are expressions of how you might fund the amount of an assessment. And I'm wondering if that's contrasted from the authorized assessment itself, which seems to be more at the heart of our case.
Yes, Your Honor, and actually that gets me into my very next point. Mr. Snyder had brought up the fact that they could have funded the whole amount through assessment in 2017. Well, the question that you were asking as to what statute provides the funding mechanism is 5829C52E, and it specifically talks about the funding, and it says it may not exceed, an assessment on a member insurer may not exceed in a calendar year 2% of the member insurer's annual premiums. So I was really curious, and I asked the trust, this is not part of the record, but this is just generally, I asked the trust what its premiums were in 2017 and what its average was over those 3 years. In 2014, it was $11 million. In 2015, it was $13 million. It averaged overall about $14 million. Well, 2% of that is $280,000. The total obligation that would be assessed upon the trust's little tiny 1% interest is $385,000. So they could not have assessed the trust for the entire amount due pursuant to statute under its own statutory authority, and that is just the trust's measly 1%. I could only imagine what an insurer like Blue Cross Blue Shield's percentage would be in that situation. So I think that answers your question. I would like to get into a little bit about the retroactivity argument. We are not, nor have we ever, made the argument that, you know, if we had actually had liability on us, we couldn't be subject to that. The problem is the statute does not provide for liability following our departure as members. And so this is not about retroactivity. But further, and I find it interesting, and I know that this was not necessarily part of Mr. Snyder's oral argument, but it was made in his brief, you know, they talk so much about their ability to continue to assess the trust post Senate Bill 37 and about retroactivity and that. But then in the very next breath, they say, well, when it comes to ERISA, the argument doesn't matter because the statute had been repealed in the first place. The long story short, justices, is that if the association gets to assess a member based on a repealed statute, then ERISA most certainly comes into play in that situation. Now, as to, I believe, Justice Devaney, it was your question with regard to being whether or not the association could ever get a benefit. One, I actually do have the former version, the prior to 2020 version, of the code in front of me. And it does specifically still exclude MEWAs, multiple employer welfare arrangements, from coverage in the prior version as well as in the current version. But additionally, we could never have gotten coverage anyway because when we joined the association in 2014, the reason we had joined the association is that we were fully self-funded because we were complying with the MET statutes in 5818. And so we were fully self-funded in the first place. We would have never received a benefit practically anyway. Ultimately, the association's power to assess is based on what is stated in 5829C and its plan of operation. Nothing in the statutes permits the association to assess the trust when it's no longer a member. I believe we fully summarized the statute stating that, you know, that was fully, and the statutes fully anticipate the fact that that there may be calling upon certain other members when an other member does not have to make an assessment. So I believe that that is covered there. Nothing in the plan of operation allows for the association to make an assessment on what Penn Treaty is, which were assessments based on insolvencies. If somehow the court feels that there's authority to authorize that assessment after July 1st, 2019, then the ERISA exclusive benefit rule dictates that 5818-88 must be preempted. Respectfully, we would request the court to reverse the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to express my appreciation to counsel for your arguments this morning. Thank you. And the case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.